From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel. This is a guide to visitors, where local people tell true stories from their own lives. Our final storyteller is Gary Heide. Gary's story takes place when he was trying to figure out what he wanted to do with his life. He originally told this story on July 23, 2009, at the Rendezvous.
In 1975, I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. That's the joke. And someone handed me a copy of Thornton Wilder's The Eighth Day, and I began reading it and immediately identified with the protagonist, John Ashley, who was accused falsely of murdering his best friend. He was going to be executed but was rescued miraculously by six masked men on a train. He never saw his family again. When I finished that novel, someone handed me Thornton Wilder's Theophilus North. And Theophilus North is about a schoolteacher that resigns his job and in one summer lives out all the nine lives he ever wanted to experience as a child. And I identified even more strongly with that protagonist because seven of the nine lives were things that I wanted to do when I became an adult. So immediately I decided I had to get hold of Thornton Wilder. And I had no way to do that, but I found what I thought was an address, and I wrote a fan letter, basically, and I waited for 2 weeks for a response, and the letter came back, and I was already depressed, and that just about pushed me over the edge. So I sat down, and I wrote another letter, and this time I called Harper Row publisher, and I got a young man on the phone that thought Wilder was dead. And I said, you know, you really shouldn't work there if you don't know if your writers are alive or dead. And so I wrote a second letter. I put it in with the first letter, and I sent it off to this address, and it came back in about 2 weeks, and I was really depressed. So I remembered from Our Town, the play Our Town, little Rebecca is telling the story. Oh, did you hear? Jane Crowfoot got the most amazing letter, and here's how it was addressed. To Jane Crowfoot, Crowfoot Farms, New Hampshire, the United States of America, the Western Hemisphere, the Earth, the universe, the mind of God. Isn't that amazing? And so I used that address, and I sent it to Thornton Wilder, Connecticut, because I didn't even know where, but I knew Connecticut. And the United States of America, and the Western Hemisphere, and the Earth, the universe, the mind of God. And about 9 days later, I received a letter, October the 6th, 1975, and it said, "Dear Mr. Heide, thank you for your kind words. I'm 78 years old. I'm half blind. I'm recovering from a serious operation, but I'm cheerful. I'm so happy that you're writing your own novel. However serious you think it is, you should take a break occasionally and maybe consider the sublime. I'm so happy that you have a musician in your home. Sincerely, Thornton Wilder. 50 Deepwood Drive, Hamden, Connecticut. Now I'm armed with an address, and I'm going to write the letter I always wanted to write." So I wrote another letter, and I asked all the questions that I'd been holding back, and then I finished it with really cogent questions like, "Do you have anyone that takes care of you, and could I send you some cookies?" I also said, "Please do not feel like you have to answer this immediately because I know you're not well, but I really, really, really need to know the answers to these questions." So I waited 2 months, and literally I waited by the mailbox every day, and I was getting more and more depressed. And finally I woke up on Saturday, December the 6th in a panic, and I decided that I had to get hold of Wilder that day. So I got on the phone, and I called every Wilder within 30 miles of Hamden, Connecticut. And, of course, I couldn't reach anyone that I needed to reach because they had unlisted numbers. In fact, half of the Wilders had never heard of Thornton Wilder. So I went to bed really depressed, and I was depressed all day Sunday. And Monday morning, I got up and turned on the CBS Morning News. And Charles Kuralt did a brief news survey, and then he said, "Three-time Pulitzer Prize winner Thornton Wilder died in his Hamden, Connecticut home Saturday, December the 7th, and I just crashed." So I found all of my favorite Wilder passages. I lit candles, and I had a memorial service in my living room. My wife took the kids shopping, and on the way out, she said, "I think you need to get some counseling." What I decided to do instead was read all of the press releases so I could get a name of a relative. And the relative's name that I got was Tappenwilder. He was a nephew. So I wrote to Tappenwilder, 50 Deepwood Drive, and I said this. I lied. I said, before your uncle died, I was planning to come see him. And even though he's no longer with us, surely someone knows him well enough that they could answer my questions. I still want to come. About 10 days later, I received a letter from I. Wilder, 50 Deepwood Drive, and I didn't know who it was until I opened the letter, and it was from Isabel Wilder. Isabel Wilder was Wilder's sister, basically his caretaker, his executor, his right-hand person for about 50 years of his literary career. And she said, thank you for your wonderful letter. I'm currently answering 800 letters of condolence. I'm really happy that you had one letter from him. Do not come. And then the very strange P.S. Dear Mr. Heide, in case you do decide to come, here is my private number. Do not give it to anyone. Okay, so that was December. In April, my wife and I and another couple were in New York, and I called the number. And this chirpy little voice, kind of like Helen Hayes, for those of you that remember Helen Hayes, answered the phone. Hello. And I said, Miss Wilder. She said, yes, who's this? And I said, it's Gary Heide. And she said, are you here? And I said, no, I'm in New York, but I'd really like to come see you. And she said, how about Thursday? And I said, fine, I'll be there. And I said, but how would I get there? And she said, well, it's very simple, dear. You just go to Grand Central Station, you buy a ticket, you get up in New Haven, Hamden, and call me. You have my number. And she said, so I'll see you then. So I took the train, I got off in Hamden, and I called her on the phone. And I said, she said, are you here, dear? And I said, no, but I will be, I think, in about an hour. She said, well, where are you? I said, I'm in New Haven, Hamden. She said, oh, no, you're here. Don't get back on the train. And she said, I forgot to ask you, are you old or young? And I had just turned 29, and I thought, I'm old. And she said, oh, good, you're young. How will I recognize you? And I said, I'm wearing a white trench coat. Okay, 1976. And I said, how will I know you? And this is exactly what she said. I'm a little old lady in a gray Mercedes. And she wasn't making a joke, because 10 minutes later, a gray Mercedes pulled into the parking lot, and I looked to see if it was her, and it looked like Wilder and drag. I mean, it never occurred to me that siblings could look so much alike. So I got in the car, and she was very loving, and she said, oh, Gary, I'm so glad that you come all the way from Indiana to spend the day with me. And I thought, oh, I'm spending the day with Isabel Wilder. You know, I thought we would say hello, and she would ask me to get back on the train. She said, now, I've planned the entire day. I hope you don't mind. And I said, no, what have you planned? And she said, are you hungry? And I said, very. Well, you know, Yale is right here at New Haven, and there's a private club, and Wilder's kind of a god at Yale. So I made a private reservation. Let's go there. Okay, so we pull up in front of the restaurant, and she pulls up over the curb three or four times trying to park the car. And she says, now, I never talk about my health, but you need to know that I have a deteriorating spine condition. So you're going to have to help me into the restaurant, and I promise you I'll never mention my health again because it's so boring. So I help her into the restaurant, and for those of you that don't know, Wilder wrote The Merchant of Yonkers, which was turned into the musical Hello, Dolly. And when we walked into the restaurant, it was like a scene out of Hello, Dolly. Miss Wilder's here! Miss Wilder's here! Miss Wilder's here! And we were escorted back inside the restaurant to a private room where we were going to have dinner. And as we came in, people were saying, oh, it's Isabel Wilder, it's Isabel Wilder. So this lineup of people shot back into the room, and one at a time they came in to see Isabel. And what she did is she deferred everyone immediately to me. Oh, it's President Kingman Brewster. President Brewster, this is Gary Heide. He's come all the way from Indiana. So immediately she set me at ease, and before the salads arrived, she was confiding in me. And she said, oh, I've been so upset, Gary. She said, there are two biographies coming out. Neither of them are authorized. And both of them suggest that Thornton was a homosexual. And she got very teary. And I said, oh, Miss Isabel, no one would really care. No one that loves his work would really care. Do you think not? Well, he wasn't. I would know, because I'm his sister. And she said, I bet that you would like to see one of his manuscripts. And I said, oh, could I please? And she said, I just knew you were going to ask. I have none of them at home. And of course, I was going to be very disappointed until she said, but right before Thornton died, he said, Isabel, I know somebody's going to come up here and want to see one of my manuscripts. So let's give them to the Beinecke. Because, you know, Don is doing such a wonderful job with the manuscripts that I for Gertrude Stein that I helped give to the Beinecke. And I said, and what is the Beinecke? And she said, oh, how provincial of me. It's right across the street. It's the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Let's go there because I know Don and maybe he'll let you see a manuscript. So I helped her across the street and we approached this amazing building and they have the largest collection of rare books and manuscripts in the world. And all of these amazing glass cases. But we headed downstairs where Don Gallup's office is. And I had just recently read about Don Gallup in a book called Charmed Circle about Gertrude Stein and all of the luminaries that used to go to their apartment in Paris. So we go downstairs, and Miss Isabel says, oh, I'm so sorry. I don't have an appointment to see Don. And we hear this voice, Isabel, is that you? Come on in. So we walk into the room, and Don Gallup is seated behind his desk. And she says, Don, this is Gary Hyde. He's come all the way from Indiana. He reaches forward. He picks up a big pile of papers, and he goes, this Gary Hyde? He has every letter that I've written Wilder sitting right in front of him at that moment. And if I doubted that I was supposed to be there, that fairly well cleared up that situation. Miss Isabel kind of got quiet at that point. That was just a little too strange. And he said, and it's very serendipitous that you would come right now because first of all, I'm cataloging Gary's letters, some of the last Wilder received, and I can show you the new room that we've done dedicated to him, so come with me. So we walk in, and it's just this very plain 8x10 room with a bunch of filing cabinets with all of these this amazing correspondence and this bust of Wilder. And she said, Don, you know, Gary so much wants to see a manuscript. And he said, certainly, what would you like to see? Our Town, Skin of Our Teeth, The Bridge of San Luis Rey. And I said, how about Theophilus North? And he said, fine. So he went to get it, and she had been kind of quiet, but suddenly she perked up, and she said, oh, Theophilus North, I remembered. It's the last novel that he wrote. It was 1972. He had been so sick, and he said, he woke up, and he said, Isabel, take me to the Five and Dime. I'm going to write a new novel. And I said, why the Five and Dime? And she said, oh, because he bought a different notebook of different color for every chapter. So Gallup pulls out this huge wad of notebooks, all different colors. They're bound. He undoes one, and he hands me the first one. And of course, you know, I practically memorized the novel, the first line. In 1926, I resigned from my job. And the minute I read those words and saw his handwriting, I literally started weeping. And the minute I started weeping, she started weeping, and Don Gallup was very embarrassed. And she said, oh, Gary, hon, you can stay here all day long and go through these manuscripts, but wouldn't you like to see the house? And I said, I think I would. Okay, for those of you that don't know, in 1929, Wilder received the Pulitzer Prize for The Bridge of San Luis Rey. And he took the money and he built this amazing house for his family called the House the Bridge Built. So here we are whizzing down Whitney Avenue, and I can't wait to see this house. And she pulls down Deepwood Drive, and she pulls off to the side. And I'm thinking, what's going on? And she said, do you like to play games? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, good. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to let you out here. You're going to walk 2 blocks to the house. That'll give me time to park the car underneath the house. You ring the doorbell. I'll be upstairs by then. And we'll play Thornton's Here. And I said, I'm sorry, what are we going to play? And she said, we're going to play Thornton's Here. It's a wonderful game. So she let me out. And I watched the car drive away, and suddenly I broke into a run because I couldn't wait to play Thornton's Here. I gave her just enough time to get upstairs. I rang the doorbell. She opened the door. She looked at me. She smiled, and she turned and looked over her shoulder, and she said, Thornton, Gary's here. And I looked past her, and I actually said, where is he? And she said, he's in by the piano. Now, here's how it works. He will never talk to somebody that he hasn't met until he plays duet piano with them. So I went, do you play? And I said, I used to play. And she said, well, great. So you go in and you look through the duet piano pieces and you pick out something and you two go ahead and play a duet piece and I'll get you boys something to eat and drink. And she literally skipped into the kitchen. Her spinal condition had cleared up. So I go in, and I'm looking at this amazing house, and I'm sorting through the piano pieces, kind of wondering where he is. Is he seated at the piano? You know, and before I can really even start, and the pieces were way too hard, 7 flats, I would have never made it. She said, okay, boys, over here. And she walks in and she has a tray with two little lemon lime drinks and some cookies. And she sets it down on this table. She said, Gary, you sit here, and this will be where Thornton sits. And she said, now, you need to understand. Right before Thornton died, he said, Isabel, surely someone will come here and want to ask a bunch of questions about my life. And you remember my life better than I do. So you're the perfect person. So, Gary, ask me anything you would have asked him. And for the next three hours, I asked her everything that I had ever wanted to ask him. And if I paused, then she would fill in the blanks with things like, you did know that Thornton and Freud were good friends. And I said, no, I had no idea. And she said, yes, well, Freud was doing a study of the creative mind, and he had Thornton over. Of course, Thornton refused to talk about the creative process, unlike that O'Neill who talked about that crazy family of his endlessly. She said, well, no wonder Freud thought all artists were neurotic. And then she would say things like, did you find him didactic? And I said, well, actually, Miss Isabel, that's what I really liked about him. She said, oh, it was too much, just too much. And then she realized what she'd said. She said, of course, I probably shouldn't say that. She said, now, when's your train? And I said, it's about 5:30. And she said, oh, then we have just a little over an hour, and you haven't even seen the studio. So we go upstairs, we walk up the stairs, and the first door on the right is this amazing studio. And we walk in, and she stands by the door, and she said, go on in. And there's, you know, his desk with the back of it facing the door, and there's a little daybed to the left, and the roof line is slanted in. There's a window here and one down at the end of the hall, and all lined in books. And she said, now, you know, I haven't really been in here since he died. I can't do it. But look, he was writing something there. I want you to go in and sit down and touch everything. She said, see what he was writing. Oh, look, there's some letters opened on that table over there. They're old. Probably he was reading them. Why don't you see what they are? Lie down on the bed. Read everything. Touch the books. Touch everything. I'm going to be down the hall, and if you need me, just call. So I thought I had died and gone to heaven. And I walked in, and I sat down at the desk, and there was a note that he had written to himself that said, must finish Emporium. And I had no idea what that was. Later I found out that was a play he'd been working on for years and never finished. Then I went and I picked up a letter dated 1955 from Louise Talma, who had taken one of his short stories and made an opera out of it. He was obviously reading that. And there were all of these first editions from Wilder, 74 different language translations of most of his books, special first edition copies to Wilder from Steinbeck, from Faulkner. There, you know, he was a Joyce scholar, so all of Joyce's works, you know, were just like ribbons of notes coming out of them. And so I picked up one off the shelf, and it was in Icelandic because it had all of these diphthongs. And I literally had a breakdown. And I was sobbing so hard. Then I stopped for a moment, and I heard somebody else sobbing. And I look at the door, and there's Miss Isabel, and she's crying. And she said, come over here, honey, come over here. So I put the book back, and I walked over, and she said, now turn around and face the room. She said, I have lived here since 1930, 46 years. She said, I cared for my parents, both of my parents, until they died. I have literally taken care of all of Wilder's, all of his business. You know, even when he wasn't here for years and years, I was here maintaining the house. When he wanted me to sell it, I still hung on. I've never had a servant of any sort. I've always taken care of this house on my own. But now I'm going to have to move because it's just too much. So please take a picture of this room in your mind so that you'll remember, because you'll be one of the last people to ever see it. And of course, I did, and I think I could reassemble a lot of that room. And she said, now hurry, let's come with me. So we walked down, and the first door on the left was Wilder's bedroom. And I was thinking, master suite, it'll be amazing. It was this little teeny room, looks like a monk cell, little single bed, braided rug, a couple of pictures. She said, now come with me. So we walked down at the end of the hall, and it's her bedroom. And it's dark, except there's a pen light on this painting. And she said, go up and see if you know what it is. And so I look at it, and she said, now, do you recognize that? And I recognize it because it was Gertrude Stein's living room. And somebody had taken, very meticulously, recreated all of these Picassos. And I said, yes, that's 27 Rue de Fleur. And she said, oh, yes, you know the artist. And I said, no. And she said, Francis Rose. And I said, I'm sorry, I've never heard of him, but he was really talented. She said, in 1936... Thornton and I were visiting Gertrude, and she took us outside, and she said, you must buy something from Francis because he's starving to death. And she said, so we bought this little picture, and sadly, you know, he was so tortured because he could just never really have any success with his art that he killed himself. And she said, you know, I have read the greatest manuscripts of the last century. And Gary, most of those writers never had their works published. And sadly, many of them committed suicide. And she said, so let me ask you something. And I said, what? She said, have you had a wonderful day? And I said, oh, Miss Isabel, this has been the most wonderful day of my life. She said, will you make me a promise? And I said, I'll promise you anything. She said, will you go back to Indiana, and whether or not you ever finish your novel and whether or not it ever gets published, promise me that you'll just live. And I said, I promise. So we got in the car, and we were headed back to the station. And there had been a question burning, a burning question that I'd wanted to ask her, but I was just afraid I would ruin the day. And finally, I just thought, okay, well, I'll never see her again, so I need to ask. And I said, Miss Isabel, there's one more thing I'd like to ask. Do you mind? And she said, honey, you can ask me anything. And I said, did he ever say anything about my letters? And she said, oh, heavens, I'm a crazy old woman. Didn't I tell you? Why, yes, they came on a Saturday. I remember it very well. The postman rang this big package. He couldn't get to the mailbox. And Wilder started down the steps. And he said, what is it, Isabel? Is there anything in there for me? And she said, there's this great big package, and it says Indiana on it. And he said, well, it's from some damn neophyte writer from Indiana, and I'm not going to read it, but give it here. So he took it upstairs. And she said, he never missed lunch. But I called him. And I said, Thornton, lunch, and he wouldn't answer. And finally, I heard him grunt something, so I thought, okay, he's busy. About an hour later, he comes down, and I said, what on earth have you been doing? And he said, I've been reading these letters from this boy from Indiana. And she said, what boy? And he said, Isabel, I found him. And then she just drives on, like that's the end of the story. And I said, I'm sorry, Miss Isabel. He said, what? And she said, he said, I found him. So she pulls into the lot, and I said, you're going to have to explain. I don't understand. What do you mean I found him? And she said, oh, here I go again. Crazy old woman. You did know that Thornton was a twin. And I said, no. And she said, well, yes, had a twin brother who died shortly after birth. And as a young boy, Thornton vowed that in this lifetime he would find that twin. Now, scholars believe that the protagonist of Thornton's novels were based on our brother Amos, and some of them were. But basically, what he did is he tried to imagine what his twin would have been like had he grown up, and he tried to base everything on that. And dear boy, I don't know what it was that you said in your letters or how you said it, but it was something. And somehow he thought it was you. And that's what this day has been all about. Thank you.
Gary, did you ever see Isabel again after that day?
No, I was probably 8 or 10 years went by. I mean, we were in communication, and I was going to New York, and I, you know, contacted her and said, I'd really love to come see you. It's been so long. And she didn't really commit, but she called my wife later and said, oh, I'd really love for Gary to come and visit again, but you know, I just want him to remember me the way I was, that wonderful day that we had together. And she had a deteriorating spine condition, which I think I mentioned in the story. And, of course, it got much worse, and she couldn't sit up. And, you know, I mean, it was really sweet that she didn't really want me to remember her that way, but it wouldn't have mattered to me at all. But, you know, I honored her wishes and didn't go see her, although I really wanted to. I've told the story numerous times to a variety of students over the years. And one of the things that I try to point out, and one of the things that I think has the biggest effect, is I try to say, you know, when you're getting signals, when you're getting a little still small voice within that's compelling you to do something, and even though people say to you, oh, that's really insane, or why are you doing that, or, you know, that's crazy, that you just must follow it. You must do it. And it's not so that you'll meet somebody famous or, you know, get anything out of it. It's just because you need to do it. I mean, I believe that we're compelled to do things all the time by our higher self. And, you know, that little voice can't compete with that ego voice in your head that's telling you how crazy all of it is, and plus the fact that you'll find plenty of people that try to discourage you too. And I've received lots of feedback from students over the years that I'm so glad that you said that because, you know, I followed up on something that I felt compelled to do and it really turned out to be the best thing. So anyway, so the story has had some value beyond just the telling.
Gary Heide recently moved to British Columbia from Seattle. Until recently, he taught at the Highline Big Picture High School. He originally told his story on July 23, 2009 at the Rendezvous. A Guide to Visitors is a live, local storytelling salon. You can learn more and find more out about our next live show at kuow.org. Search for storytelling. This radio series was edited by Jim Gates. Web content was produced by Carmen Santos. Funding for this series was provided by the KUOW Program Venture Fund. Contributors include Paul and Lori Ahern and Puget Sound Energy. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel.